So welcome everyone, and thank you for coming this morning. It's Labor Day weekend. Before we begin the talk, I want to know whether, if either you're new or old, if you have any questions about the meditation practice that we did this morning, about just sitting posture, mindfulness of the body and the breath, dealing with thoughts, learning to be the master of attention. Anything just in the very simplest thing that's not clear. Important thing is everybody knows how to practice. Your silence is a silence of agreement and not the silence of just wanting to stay silent, not ask a question. Again, we have rare opportunities to come together, so it's if we have any questions, any confusions, things we're not clear about, this is the time to clear it up. So what I wanted to talk about this morning was a mindfulness, but in the context of kind of the Buddhist meditative tradition. I want to do that because starting in about a month, we'll have several what we call intensives in our community, dealing with the two foundational teachings going back to the Buddha, 2,600 years ago, on mindfulness. One is the Anapanasati Sutra, which deals with mindfulness, but especially with the breath. It's called Full Awareness of the Breath. And the second one is the Satipatthana, or the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. So mindfulness is something that has always been the foundation and very central to the Buddhist path of awakening. But it's interesting, as all of you know, the word mindfulness has definitely creeped into our culture. There is many people writing about mindfulness, teaching mindfulness, and the world of mindfulness, and you know, is epidemic. You know, everything is mindfulness these days. People, I think, are often doing what they've always done, but they just put on the word mindfulness. Kind of like a little extra add-on, a little extra value. And again, it's everywhere. You know, we offer, through our Mindfulness Institute, we offer all kinds of classes or workshops on mindfulness in education, mindfulness in stress, mindfulness in habit change, mindfulness in relationships, as well as in the outer world. There's this mindfulness. I mean, we've had one of our members who's a lawyer who does mindful lawyering, offering a course on mindfulness and the law, mindful leadership. I don't know, that's something I could go on and on, but it's, you know, there's now mindfulness therapy, mindfulness and therapy, mindfulness and depression, mindfulness and anxiety, mindfulness and addictions. Mindfulness is throughout our society. And again, whether that's helpful or not helpful really has to do whether it is really helping people. That's the obvious, most important criteria. But I think it's important here that we understand that mindfulness was not a thing, a practice, outside of the larger Buddhist path. Actually, on Friday night, I met with our wake-up group, people in their 20s and 30s. And one of the things we talked about, that it's, I think, very hard for Americans, Westerners, to understand the difference between a path and traditional religion. I mean, most of us grew up in traditional religion, where it often means there is something I believe in. There's a church or temple or mosque that I attend, and I do my best to just kind of follow the general tenets of my religion. So that's all good, isn't it? But what Buddha taught was a path that had a beginning and an end. Right? He talked about a journey. And there are many ways of conceptualizing that journey, but it really was from suffering to the cessation of suffering, from unhappiness to happiness, from the world of emotional afflictions to the world of positive emotionality. Right? I mean, there are many ways of talking about it, but he clearly, it's a path that has an end result. And that end result is different from where we began. It's a path. And like a path, it is clearly defined. Right? When we follow a path, it has sides to it. It has markers. Right? It is delineated from other paths. So when we walk in the woods, we know where we're taking this trail and not that trail. This trail goes here, that trail goes there. That's the green trail, the purple trail, the yellow trail, the blue trail. So, you know. And if it's a fairly long trail or path, you know, we can get a guidebook, right? That'll tell us. First here and there, watch out for that turn. The trail may look, you may not see it clearly here, but go this way, right? It takes us from where we begin to where we want to get to. So there's a path that we are walking. Path of awakening, a path of enlightenment, a path of cessation of suffering, a path of to happiness, a path to emotional stability. I mean, there are all kinds of ways to define that path to where we're going, but it is a path, and then all the practices that we do are in the context of that movement. Right? They're not static. They're not necessarily kind of one-shot therapeutic, right? So often when we go into therapy or see a therapist is because we have a specific kind of problem, right? We're depressed, we're anxious, we have relationship issues, we have anger issues, we have addiction issues. But usually we go there for some kind of intervention so we can be free of that, whatever it is, okay? Or that'll be remediated, it won't be less intense. So it's kind of a one-shot affair. It's a very time-limited affair with a very specific kind of intervention. It's sort of like when you go to your doctor, you see her or him because you have a specific problem, right? And once that problem is taken care of, you don't keep going back, do you? Your problem, you had a problem, it was taken care of, there was an intervention, but you don't keep going back. You don't usually see the doctor for wellness. If you want wellness, you go somewhere else. Wellness is about a lifestyle. It's more encompassing than just treating a specific ailment. Right? We might say that wellness of body and mind is a path that one walks in life. And it encompasses many things. What we eat, what we don't eat, how we sleep, sleep habits, exercise habits, things we do for our mind. You know, I mean, all kinds of things are all part of that wellness program. Right? We walk the path of wellness and well-being for our body and mind. So, in the context of the Buddhist path, that which is called mindfulness is not just being in the present moment. It is not just bare attention. It is not simply being present for the sake of being present. Now, again, it does not mean that that is not the way it is taught and that is not beneficial. And actually, my own teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, had a lot to do with establishing that. But if you read him, you realize when he uses the word mindfulness, it's much bigger than that. But for many people, they teach it in this very simplistic way that has no context, that has no path. It's just, you know, do this. And obviously, if one learns to be present, right, if one is less distracted, if one is able to be present to oneself and those around them and to the things that are going on in their life and their eating, that is what? Yeah, that'll make life better. So that's all good. Right? That's all good. But that's not the path. The path is bigger than that. It has a bigger context. Mindfulness was recommended as the foundation of the path of meditation because it has a very specific meaning. And the word is sati in Pali, smriti in Sanskrit. And it involves the idea of being present to something. But it also has an equal meaning of remembering, memory, recollection. Right? So if you could imagine, right, let's say I'm walking. I am aware of every step. See, this is the cliff. I am aware of every step. I am aware of every step. I am aware of every step. I'm totally mindful of my steps. I'm totally mindful of the steps. I'm aware that I'm falling down the cliff. Right? And you might say, hey, wasn't I practicing mindfulness? Well, you were. So in terms of the very simplistic way of understanding mindfulness, you get an A. Unfortunately, you're dead. There's a problem, you see. There's a context. There's a context. And that is why the word smriti and sati implies presence, but it also implies recollection, memory. I know where I am. I remember. I am mindful of what I'm doing, and I'm mindfulness of it in a context, right? You know, it's very interesting that always the context for the undertaking in Buddhist tradition of undertaking of mindfulness and meditation was always a foundation in some kind of ethical context. Okay? Which again, in modern day mindfulness, you never hear about. The context. Because mindfulness was about and part of a path of transformation. And one of the parts of healing and transformation is to stop doing actions of body, speech, and mind that create suffering for yourself and others. So it was always understood within the context of this path that until we got the actions of our body, speech, and mind, we stopped doing harmful actions in the actions of our body, in the actions of the words we say, and in the way we are thinking, there will always be instability and emotional upheavals going on in the mind, which makes it very difficult to what? To meditate. To concentrate, right? When you are lost in anger, when you are lost in fear, when you are lost in sadness, your ability to see what's going on clearly, what's around you, is what? Nil, if not next to nil. Okay? So, part of the path, part of the context in which we undertake a meditative discipline is the context of some kind of ethics. But the ethics in Buddhism is really about, again, you know, creating the basis for harmonious relationships, so the mind, when it comes to meditation, when it comes to mindfulness practice, already has a kind of stability to it. Right, for those of you who are practicing meditation, and if there's just a lot of drama, a lot of conflict, a lot of emotional upheaval, you know, going on in your life, a lot of instability, how do you find your meditation goes? How do you find the ease of concentration? Very difficult. Very difficult. So it is important to understand, that is fully understood, that the practice of mindfulness and meditation is based on this context of kind of leading a virtuous life. This is not being a goody two-shoes. This is leading a virtuous life, a noble life. You know, that the actions of one's body and speech and one's mind are actually good and creating goodness. And we're treating ourselves and other people in a non-harming way. We are not acting or putting things into our body or acting in a toxic way to ourselves, or we're not trying to do that to other human beings. Okay? I mean, Buddhist morality are not commandments from above, but they come out of a deep looking into the nature of life, the nature of relationships, and kind of trying to understand what are the kind of actions that cause most harm in life, in relationships, and destabilize the mind. So this larger context has to be understood. Now, if you look into these four foundations of mindfulness sutras and the full awareness of the breath sutras, you see they are not, the Buddha doesn't say, and now I want to teach you mindfulness. Right? He says, now I want to teach you a path that will free you from your suffering. That's how he introduces his teaching. Let me teach you something that is incredibly powerful. It is the way that one can end one's suffering. Okay? He did not say, you know, I want to now teach you guys and gals how to enjoy an apple. How to enjoy a walk in the woods. He does actually talk about enjoyment, but that's not the purpose of why he's introducing this teaching on mindfulness, on full awareness. There's a bigger context that he's trying to get his students, who's ever listening, to see, to understand. And so while there's many different kinds of teachings in the sutras, we could, you know, I'm just trying to give sort of an introduction for those who will be taking the intensives, or those who are interested in it. And while these two sutras are different and they have different, the idea of mindfulness begins by saying one has to learn to be mindful or present or aware we'll begin with the first three, right? First one is in the body. I am aware of my body. You know, we are in bodies. We are embodied, we might say. We are incarnated in a body. Our whole journey in life, from birth to death, goes on in a body. When we look at each other, what do we see? Bodies. We don't see minds, we see bodies. We say birth when we see a body pop out. We say we see death when we see a body no longer moving. Right? So we are incarnated in a body. But what is intimately, what's that experience of being in a body? Most of us know our bodies from the outside, how it looks in the mirror, how we want to present, how we want our hair to be, how we want to dress it, you know, and we use our bodies often as objects and other people's bodies as objects. But what is my experience of being in a body? What does it feel like, really? What are the sensations of being in a body? What's going on in this body? Is it a solid thing? What are sensations that occur in the body? Do they just come and go? Are there pleasant and unpleasant sensations in the body? What are they like? What are they really like? Not when I call comfortable, uncomfortable, but what are they like as just an experience? What is it like to be in my body, as a body? So the Buddha said, this is what we need to begin with. Right? To know ourselves as a body. Now, also in the body are the sense organs, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, sensing. So that's also part of body experience. So what is that like? To be aware, what is seeing, what is hearing? You see, and he's kind of breaking it down. Body, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting. What's it like to be in it? He also says, what's it like to be outside and observing it? And what's it like to go inside? So there are all kinds of meditations in it, but that's what we're trying to understand. We're trying to understand who we are. And what does it really mean to be a human being from the inside? Mostly we're thinking about what it means to be a human being, or we're thinking about our life, or we're thinking about other people's life, but we're not actually experiencing it directly. So the first thing is what? Body. Mindfulness of the body. Next, we move into something called feelings. Again, feelings aren't, in this case, emotions. They're not emotions. They really have to do with something that most of us are unaware of, but is very important. It's called the dana. And what meditators, when they really observe what's going on in their body, mind, they realize as soon as one of our senses, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, or even our mind, makes contact with an object, there is immediately, unconsciously, a movement toward, if we find it pleasurable, a movement away, if we find it negative, or just neutral. And that this vedana, this moving toward, this moving away, or this indifference is going on all the time, and it is very much propelling us towards and away from. And it is a very powerful condition of our behavior, of our emotions, and our thoughts. But we don't even know what's going on. So these foundations of mindfulness, when we begin to meditate in this way, are kind of uncovering for us what is actually going on. See, at this point, for most of us, everything is fused, right? Body, sensations, emotions, thoughts, actions, reactions. It all just kind of what? Boom. And boom. And boom. Like. Dislike. Want. Need. Happy. Unhappy. Right? You know what I'm saying? We're just kind of, things are just happening. All our spheres of experience are all fused. So this is a process of kind of beginning to unfuse it and kind of beginning to break our experience down into parts, but seeing them as a process. Okay, so there's the body. Body makes contact through all the senses, mind. Positive, negative, toward, away, pleasure, unpleasure, you know what I mean? This is what's going on all the time. We see something, before we know it, we're drawn to it. Why do we draw to it? Because there's a positive response. We move toward it. We don't even know that's going on. We move away from it. Right? It's conditioning so much of our behavior, but we don't even know it in our thoughts. Okay. The third area is the mind. Mindfulness of my own mind, which implies that I am aware of what's going on inside it. In a very kind of scientific, objective way. Can I just observe my mind as a mind and see thoughts, see emotions, see memories, see images, and just kind of see this, as these are the things that are going on in the mind, but also see how they move, how they arise, how they disappear, how they get stuck, where I get stuck, where I don't get stuck. Right? And again, usually we, you know, our minds, which is conditioning all of our experience, is for most of us what? Unknown territory, right? Terra incognito. It's like an unexplored land. Right? Even though it is our mind through which everything is experienced and is conditioning all our experiences, for most of us, we don't have a clue what's going on in there, do we? Because we're always looking where? Out there. And yet, the very source of our happiness or our unhappiness, our suffering, etc., or our lack of suffering, is all occurring within our mind. And yet, it is a foreign territory to us. Right? So, the third foundation of mindfulness and the practices therein are helping us turn this telescope around. Right, the telescope that's always looking out, always spying on our neighbors. Right, we're always watching everybody else, watching everybody else's mind. We kind of take that telescope, take that microscope, take that spyglass, and we turn it around, and we learn to watch our own mind. But again, a careful reading of these teachings is not simply just to note and observe. It is in the context of recalling and remembering what is wholesome and what is not wholesome. What is leading to the cessation of suffering, and what is the cause of suffering, or is a suffering state. So mindfulness, again, is not simply bare attention and going, oh yeah, I'm really furious at this person, and now I'm just telling him every negative thing I could about him. Right? But I'm aware of that. Right? You know. It's like telling a child, just be aware, you know, as you're putting your finger, you know, in the electrical outlet, just, you know, just tell me what your moment-to-moment experience is. I want you to remember what is dangerous and what is not dangerous. So mindfulness implies a context in which mindfulness is being practiced, or else it has no meaning, right? So when we are exploring our mind, when we are exploring Vedana, again, it's in this bigger context. We want to end our suffering. We want to be open-hearted. We want to take the walls down that separate us from each other. Well, you know, I don't see any walls. Where are they? They have to be where? In my mind. Oh, well, let me go looking. Are there walls? All these ideas we have about ourselves and everybody else. What are they? Now, the final of the four is called mindfulness of dharmas. And this is very interesting because there are many different ways of looking at this. But this is really talking about life. And the Buddha gives very clear context in that of talking about things like the seven factors of awakening, so talking like the Four Noble Truths, talking like the five hindrances or the emotional afflictions, various kinds of things. So he's giving us a context. So when we look at life, we have a way, when we look at life, and he says, when you look at life with mindfulness, when you look at life with clear comprehension, and when you look at life with energy, then you are really practicing mindfulness. Right? Am I on the right path? There's no comprehension, I'm off. But if I know where I am, what's going on, and that this is a wrong path, because this is not the path that leads to the top of the mountain with the beautiful views and the spacious skies. This is the path that just leads to suffering. We have to know that. How do we know that? Because we have practiced the four foundations of mindfulness. Right? So we know ourselves as a body and a mind. And we know how to look at our experience and the human experience and make sense of it in a coherent way. And again, in the Buddhist tradition, the coherent way is to see it in terms of this path. All human beings don't want to suffer. They want to be happy. Is that true? Is that the most fundamental thing that unites all of us as human beings? Right? Whatever the religion, whatever the ethnicity is, whatever the gender, whatever the sexual orientation, whatever it is, all of us want to be happy and free of suffering. We want that for everybody we care about, don't we? That is what we want. And the Buddha understood that. So in the context of his teachings and his meditation path, that is always the context in which these teachings are given, including and especially the teaching of mindfulness. So again, you know, it's like, what is it like? It's like prayer, okay? Something I know very little about, let me just say that. That's not my tradition. But when I have read kind of more deeply in the other traditions about prayer, it seemed like its real purpose was to connect with God. Right? To connect with God. Which is kind of a deep purpose, isn't it? If you believe in a God that is the fundamental of everything. Right? Omniscient. So prayer is a way of connecting. Very deep. It can be very transforming. And yet, what do many human beings turn prayer into? Well, let me see. If he's omniscient and he's all-powerful, then maybe he can get my daughter into college, you know? You know, maybe he can help me get that job. Or maybe he can, you know, help me win the lottery. Right? So we turn something that has a very powerful, transformative possibility, and we turn it into something incredibly worldly and small. Right? So we have to, again, I am not saying that mindfulness, the way it is being taken out of the Buddhist context and utilized in all these various dimensions, may be helpful. I mean, I certainly hope it is. But I guess what I'm just suggesting, that in the way that it was presented, and it was presented within the context of this Buddhist tradition, everybody who is practicing mindfulness outside the Buddhist tradition acknowledges that's where it comes from. But yet, there is not this acknowledgement of the context in which it was presented and utilized within that context. And I'm only sharing that tonight, or today, but I think that's important. Because I would imagine that most of the people who are here today are here because they have some relationship with this larger context in their lives and the life of their loved ones. And we call ourselves the Florida Community of Mindfulness. So I guess maybe one of the reasons I'm talking about today, to understand that when, at least for myself, when I talk about mindfulness, what I've talked to you about this morning is what I'm talking about. Not simply bare attention. Not simply something, you know, one does whatever one wants with. Right? We know that during this period of the samurai in Japan, many samurai warriors trained in Zen monasteries. Right? They learned mindfulness. They learned concentration. Now, what was the context in which they were learning it? So they could be better killers. So they could go into a battle without any sense of self and kill.
Thank you for the talk today. I wanted to hear someone talk about Buddhism in the big picture as opposed to how we approach it segmentally. And one of the things that I just wanted to sort of maybe have you share with the community here is when you're speaking to people who are non-practitioners, who are not curious about the path, but they're curious about you and what you're doing on this path, because you say, well, I go on Sundays to a spiritual place and I have a Buddhist practice, and they say, well, what is that really? And you try to explain it to them, and the myth out there is that you don't have any goal, you're just, you know, basically present and aware, and that's what Buddhism is, and it doesn't make any sense in this world that we live in. So how do you talk to a non-practitioner who is curious but really doesn't understand how you can basically be present but not have a structure or not have a purpose or a meaning because you're just supposed to be aware?
Well, again, I think it's what I shared today, that I would not say that Buddhism is just about awareness or just about living in the present moment. That's not Buddhism, right? That's, again, it's taking, you know, it's taking something out of a context, right? I mean, you were a physician in your earlier incarnation. Would you say being a physician in the biggest sense is all about delivering babies, which is what you did?
Back then, that's what I thought it was.
Right, but if I said, Alex, medicine, is it just about, I mean, is that all you learned when you entered medical school, how to deliver babies?
No, but my orientation was that medicine or health was the absence of disease. That was the way I was.
I understand, but I'm trying to make another point. The point is that you just didn't learn one thing. You just didn't learn how to deliver babies. You first started general. You got the whole picture. You learned anatomy. You learned physiology. You learned body chemistry. You learned about the whole thing. I won't get into what, you see what I'm saying? I mean, you got the bigger context, right? Right, and if you were in the old days, remember the old days of the GP, before there was a specialist for everything, they could do everything, you know, with greater or lesser skill, right? But they had a bigger context, and they were trained, you know, to know all kinds of applications, right? Taking their general knowledge and applying it specifically, right? So, again, if somebody asked me about the Buddhist path or living in the present moment, I would just say what I said today. You know, I would say, you know, Buddhism's a path. It has a beginning and an end. It's about the end of suffering. It's about the freedom from emotional afflictions. It's a freedom from the tyranny of self-absorption. I wouldn't say that to everybody, especially if somebody's very self-absorbed. They may not be ready for that one. So we keep that one to later, you know. But I certainly would talk about, you know, what's very common to the human experience, which is, I mean, I don't think anybody growing up in this society, in American society, does not know about emotional affliction, depression, anxiety, fears, stress, addictions, relational problems. You know, I mean, I think there's a context where you go, yeah, there's a lot of unhappiness and dissatisfaction and suffering in our society. There's a lot of activity that's fairly meaningless, you know, and this is a path which we kind of begin to understand why that happens, you know. See, what I like to say to people is sometimes, yeah, I can understand why you're depressed. I mean, when I was a therapist, people used to come to me sometime, now there are various kinds of depressions, but certain kinds of depressions, when people would come, I'd say, yeah, you know, I can see why you're depressed. You have a very unsatisfying life. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'd be depressed too. Right? You know, let's look at, you know, it's like there are reasons for everything. And if you're doing things that are meaningless, no wonder you feel like life is meaningless. If you're doing activities that really don't give you a sense of well-being and happiness, no wonder you don't have a feeling of well-being or happiness. There's nothing wrong. You see what I mean? People think there's what? There's something wrong with me. No, there's nothing wrong with you, but you're participating in things, ways of interacting with the world, way of thinking, way of feeling, that produce suffering. So of course you're going to suffer, right? It's like, you know, somebody going to the pulmonologist, you know, who's a two-pack-a-day smoker and complains about, you know, chest pains. Right? I mean, just to treat them, right? To give them some medication and not talk about the relationship of smoking to pulmonary problems would be an incredible disservice. Wouldn't you agree? Right? So I think, you know, if someone's asking us about what we do, it's not heavy. You know, we don't have to lay it on thick. But we need to speak, you know, to the human condition and really why someone practices a spiritual path, you know, without renouncing the world, without shaving their head, without putting on a robe. you know, I mean, in a certain way, that's easier. But for people like us who live as lay people, who have relationships, who have families, who have work, jobs, you know, homes, you know, we need to find a way that we can live in the world of all this activity and find meaning and find happiness, right? What we talked about today is a way to do that. I mean, the Buddha introduces his teachings on mindfulness in these two sutras. He calls it, this is the direct way, the ekayana. This is the direct way, right? Because it goes right to me, you see? It goes right to me. That everything that I'm experiencing in my body and mind. Well, then I need to really understand what's going on within my body and mind. Mindfulness. I need kind of a path or a map that gives me a context to putting what I'm experiencing within me in a bigger picture and realize, oh, that's what everybody's experiencing, right? I'm not unique. Now, for people who think they're very unique, that could be very disappointing. But for people who think, you know, what's wrong with me, you know, that can be very liberating. There's nothing wrong with me. Except, you know, I don't think clearly. I don't perceive things accurately. I'm lost most of the time in my own self-drama. Right? I'm cultivating negative mind states. Right? That's all. Right? You know, give me a path. You know, tell me which ones to cultivate. That's what a path is about. Right? And, you know, this is a path that has been trod for 2,600 years. Many good paths out there in the world. Fortunately, many good teachings. But, all you know, the path that I know, I'd say, wow, this is tried and true. You know, I don't have to make it up. Right? You know, I can trust. I can have confidence in. I mean, that's, you know, for those of you who are looking for a spiritual path or you're looking for a path in this world that brings some clarity and understanding and meaning and happiness in your life, you know, look for something that you can have confidence in, that you can trust. Right? That's important. Because if you don't have that, it's very hard to walk a path in life if you don't trust it. If you don't trust that it's going to take you where you want to go. If you don't trust your own capacity to walk it. If you don't trust the guides, it's not going to be a happy journey. You want a happy journey in life. So it's worthwhile, you know, to check things out. Question authority, you know, check things out. Check the teacher out, check the teachings out, check the path out, check the community out. That's good.